The new Disney film Coco is about a little boy named Miguel. He loves to play the guitar, but he has to do it secretly because it's banned in his house.
Abuelita runs our house just like Mama Imelda did.
No music! No music!
No music! I think we're the only family in Mexico who hates music. And my family's fine with that. But me?
Be back by lunch, mijo.
Love you, Mama. I am not like the rest of my family.
Hola, Miguel.
Hola.
Miguel's quest to connect with music and ultimately his own family leads him on a journey to the land of the dead, a journey steeped in Mexican folklore. Local writer Angela Cervantes has had a front row seat for Disney's foray into Mexican culture. She is the author of the junior novelization of Coco. I'm Gina Kaufman, here to talk to her about that experience on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi, Angela.
Hi, good morning.
So we just heard a little bit about Coco, but how would you describe the movie to someone who hasn't seen it?
Gosh, it's a celebration of music, Mexico, and family. That's how I would describe it.
What do you think it means for our culture, and particularly for young Latinos in our culture, that this movie exists, that it's doing so well?
Yeah, it's one of the reasons I signed up to even write the junior novel was because right away I sort of understood the weight of this film. The script was beautiful when I received it, and the portrayal of Mexico at a time where there's been a lot of anti-Mexican, anti-sentiment, anti-immigrant sentiment in this country, I felt was really important because there are a lot of Mexican-American children who, you know, can be affected by that type of hatred, and I'll just call it for what it is, hatred. And so it's important that we see ourselves on film, true representation of our culture, and that it's celebrated.
In the world of just, like, animation for children, there is actually, like, kind of a history of stereotypes of Mexican-Americans and Mexicans. Can you talk to me a little bit about your memories of maybe seeing some of that stuff as a kid?
Well, my world, I didn't see a lot of movies when I was a kid, honestly. We just didn't have that sort of extra funding around the house for movies. But books were a big time part of my life growing up, and there just simply wasn't any representation of Latinos or Mexican-American, to be more specific, in books, in children's books in particular. I don't think I read a book about a Mexican-American woman or girl until I was well into college. And it wasn't for lack of trying. You know, I had two parents that were very engaged and wanted to find books about Mexican-Americans and books that sort of reflected our culture so we could see ourselves. And they tried hard. They would bring books like books about Frida Kahlo or the Aztecs or Mayan culture to us so that we at least have something that represented our culture a little bit to us. But yeah, I didn't see those books until well into college. So it was a big it was a gap in my childhood, but it just sort of propelled me to a kid who already loved to read and loved to write at a young age to want to be a writer and want to be a voice for my community.
I want to get back to your writing pretty soon, but
sure.
With Coco, just to stick with that mm-hmm. for a little bit, you know, people are so excited about this movie. And I wonder if you can point us to, like, specific moments where you were like, they got it right. Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. There were a lot of those moments when I was reading the script. You know, one of them that I really love about how they celebrated Dia de los Muertos and how they represented it on film was they showed that it was a very joyous place and that artists, even what I really loved is that they showed all these artists in the afterlife and sort of like this land of the dead that were still doing their art. You know, there's the character of Frida Kahlo, and she's still doing this wonderful, like, performance art piece that involves a giant papaya, you know. There's one scene.
They're still out there making stuff
that's
amazing.
Yeah, they're still out there doing amazing things. There's a scene with Diego Rivera painting a nude. There's, of course, I don't want to give you spoiler alerts, but there's Ernesto de la Cruz, who's a musician in the living life, and then he's also still performing and doing these great concerts in the land of the dead. So I, as an artist, I really like that idea that I could die and still be able maybe to write or do my art in, you know, in the land of the dead. So I really like that component. I remember going, yes, they got it. But I also really like that they really got the aspects of the altars, which we call ofrendas in some parts of Mexico. And, you know, with the candles being lit, the pictures of our family members, the beautiful marigolds, if you can get them, you put them on the altar, the favorite foods of our ancestors. They just got all those little components of Day of the Dead right. And I just thought it was so beautiful.
And so it just rang true for you.
Absolutely.
So I do want to bring up that Disney made what some people have called pretty serious missteps, like trying to trademark the phrase Dia de los Muertos and having what has been called a sort of tone-deaf illegal immigration subplot. Just the idea of a spirit trying to cross illegally into the world of the living.
Oh, interesting. Oh, wow. That's really deep. Yeah, I never even caught on to that part, honestly. I'll be truthful. But the whole trademark of Dia de los Muertos was ridiculous, and they learned from it. I mean, they got smacked down pretty hard, pretty fast, and I'm glad they did. I mean, we're all going to make mistakes, and we're all going to have some failures, and hopefully we get back up and we learn from it. And you can tell that Disney Pixar learned from that. When they first asked me, which like last October, they asked me if I would write the junior novel, they were specifically looking for a Mexican-American author who wrote kids' book to do that. Yay, me. Just so happens they find me in Kansas. And I did my research before I signed that contract because I had heard about that trademark scandal. And I soon realized in my research that there were so many Mexican artists and Mexican-American artists brought in as consultants, and they were writing the other books. Matthew de la Peña writes the picture book, Miguel and His Grand Harmony. Malin Alegría writes the golden book for Coco. And then Lalo Alcaraz, one of the biggest critics of that whole trademark of the copy of Dia de los Muertos, was actually signed on as a consultant. And once I saw that Lalo Alcaraz is a cartoonist, his syndicated cartoon was called La Cucaracha, one of the first Hispanic cartoons to kind of make the mainstream. Once I saw that he was signed on, I kind of felt like, okay, I have a green light to also be involved in this project. That was really important to me, that they were starting to take the steps to show true representation and show that they had learned from their mistake.
And bringing on a critic of one of those big missteps, that's
yes,
huge.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, so the bringing in of you, that you're this, they're looking for a writer who is Mexican-American to be involved in this project, a children's book writer, that you're the person they found is incredible, that you're here in our community. And so I want to learn more about you. I mean, you've been writing children's books for the age group that's like fourth, fifth grade, that kind
yes,
of range.
Yes, that's right. Third, fourth, and fifth.
Bringing stories that represent families like yours to children's literature has been a big part of your motivation, right?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, it's been something I've been aiming for since I was 8 years old, when I first noticed the books about my community, girls like me with names like mine, that had skin like mine, weren't in those books. So it's been something I've been aiming for since I was 8 years old. It's a dream that's been forming for so many years.
I want to start with one of your previous books, because you've got a new book coming out, but let's travel back in time a little
Ooh,
bit.
Yeah.
Gabby Lost and Found is about a girl who is desperately clinging to a dream of having what she imagines as a perfect family, even though her mom was just deported to Honduras.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I wrote that book back in 2013. It was my first book my first novel. If you don't include the sequel I wrote when I was 10 years old to the Narnia Chronicles.
Would maybe include that, but
yeah, maybe I should, because
there's
a lot of work.
Most people don't know about it.
Exactly. So Gabby Lost and Found was my first middle grade novel I ever wrote, and I was lucky enough to have it published. It's about a girl whose mom is deported to Honduras, where she's from. And meanwhile, she sort of is volunteering at an animal shelter and finding her strength and her voice through her work at the animal shelter. And it was one of those books I was writing because immigration was such a hot topic at the time, and it still is. And I kind of was hoping when I was writing it, the whole time I was writing the manuscript, I kept thinking, you know, maybe by the time this is published, this story won't even be relevant anymore. Maybe there'll be some wonderful miracle and some sort of humane immigration reform will have happened in this country. And we'll kind of look back at this book as an outdated relic that, oh my God, remember when we used to separate families and take moms and dads away from their kids while the kids were at school? And people would be like, oh, it's, you know, it's sort of a history book instead of a book. But no, I mean, it's still relevant. And that's kind of sad. And it continues to do well all across the country, Gabby Lawson found. It's the book that won't die. It just got selected for, like, some
the
Idaho.
The book that won't die. You don't hear a lot of authors referring to their own work that way. And that but yeah. That is really sad to me because that is your hope, is that this book becomes irrelevant.
I really do. I mean, I think the story is sweet and beautiful, but I kind of hope that issue would just kind of go away. That whole idea of deporting families, separating families will go away. But it hasn't. And, you know, it still seems to resonate all across the country. And I still get letters and emails from kids and parents and teachers saying that they know kids in their classrooms that are suffering the same situation, or a mom who's been deported and made it back and her kids are in the same situation.
And is that, do you see that as like the primary readership? I was wondering if there could be children who would be scared of possibly having that happen to their parents and maybe scared by the book. But it seems like if they're scared, they're scared anyway.
You know, it's handled with kids' gloves. I don't, you know, because my editor did a great job in knowing where I should pull back away from on some themes. So, you know, I don't think it's scary, but it does bring up good discussion in the classroom. It does bring up good story time conversations with parents, you know, at bed at night with the kids. I mean, I've heard that from letters, and I get the most precious letters from kids that tell me that it really resonated with them. So hopefully I've done a good job and done that whole story, you know, justice.
Can you tell us about a letter you've gotten?
I'm trying to think of a most recent letter I received. There's so many, but there was one from a little kid, a little girl in Michigan, who wrote me and said that her mom had been deported, but that I love this part because she says, but my dad is much better than the dad in the book, Gabby Lawson found.
Yeah, dad is sort of checked out a little bit.
He's a little bit neglectful. And in her letter, she really wanted to point out that her dad was not like the dad in Gabby Lawson found. And so I thought that was really sweet. She was in good hands, even though she was obviously going through a lot of pain with her mom being gone. Yeah.
And then you've got another book, Allie First and Last, which this girl is from a very successful family in her community, but she is the only one in her family who has not been first at anything.
That's right. She's kind of put this pressure on herself to be number one and to make her mark before she graduates from elementary school. And her families are kind of all successful. Every single member has kind of already made their mark. And so she just feels this pressure to do whatever it takes to make her mark before she graduates. And it's also been a really popular book with kids. And it's so funny because whenever I ask the students when I go to a school visit, I say, do you guys know anyone like Allie? Anyone like Allie Velasco who just always wants to be number one and make her mark? All the kids raise their hands. They're like, yeah, we all know someone like that. Or, you know, maybe they are like that.
This is a representation of a Latino family that seems to be saying something.
Sure, it's, you know, because my first book dealt with a child who was of mixed status, meaning her mom was, you know, an immigrant to this country, a child of an immigrant. Allie is different in that her family is probably like third or fourth generation Mexican-American living in the United States. And that's quite a different reality and a different story. And it's more common with what I have, you know, with my reality. I'm a second generation Mexican-American. It was my abuelos, my grandparents, that came from Mexico on one side of my family. So, a different sort of view of a Latino representation. Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell me more about your own childhood, because I am kind of fascinated by a 10-year-old who writes a sequel to The Chronicles of Narnia.
I love C.S. Lewis. He was my favorite writer when I was a kid. Yeah, I mean, I started writing short stories and poems when I was about 8, 9 years old. I mean, you could ask my sister. She and I used to write stupid little limericks and poems back and forth to each other when we were very young, just to entertain ourselves. Hours of fun. And I just always loved reading and writing. I mean, I was a lonely child. I was a very quiet kid. I didn't like to speak up. I didn't like to talk in the classroom. But you could count on me during recess time to be either telling scary stories in the corner of the playground or reading a book that I just couldn't put down and I wanted to continue it through recess. That was just me. But, you know, what I loved about my childhood is that everyone seemed to accept that about me. No one ever tried to change me and say, oh, get that book away from you. You know, all the nuns that raised me at Our Lady of Guadalupe in Topeka, Kansas, sort of just always kept books in my hands, kept trying to find books for me and my family, too. So that's why, you know, as I got older, I started turning that love for books into a love for writing. I started thinking maybe I could write some stories.
What do you remember about, I don't mean to be obsessed with your sequel, but what do you remember about it?
Okay, so I had Latino characters introduced into Narnia because that's what I wanted. And I had a feel like it was a queen or a princess, Esperanza del Castillo. Esperanza I named after my grandma, del Castillo, just because I liked that name. It sounded like castle and I liked it. There was a Javi Sepulveda. He was a captain of a ship. I think Queen or Princess Esperanza married Prince Caspian. Yeah, it was very romantic, very sweet, lots of adventure. It was my twist on Narnia books because I love those books. They're well-written books. I still love them. But, I just wanted to see some characters that looked and sounded and like me.
I understand that you lived abroad for a while.
I did. I lived in Guadalajara, Mexico for about almost 3 years, right after I graduated from college, yeah.
What took you there?
Lots of different things. I just wanted to break away from Kansas a little bit. I'd lived all my life in Kansas, was born in El Dorado, raised in Topeka, went to Lawrence, Kansas for college, and then lived in Kansas City. And just kind of wanted to break away and live somewhere else for a while. And Guadalajara called me because it's in the state of Jalisco, and that's where my grandparents are. So it interested me in that way.
Was there anything about that experience that taught you something? I mean, the story of Coco, this brings us back to what we're here discussing today, is this young boy thinking that he's trying to break away from his own family, but what he discovers on that journey is his own family. And I wonder if, I don't know, does that resonate with you? And you're trying to break away from this place where you grew up, you go to Mexico and...
Ooh, I like that. Yeah, I wish I'd thought about it in that way. At that point, it just seems so spontaneous and crazy. But I guess there are some commonalities in that. I mean, Guadalajara to me was just a chance to live in a Mexico, which I've grown up loving Mexico from afar. And now I had this chance to live in this big cosmopolitan city. And, while I was there, I definitely found more of my writing voice. I told someone in some interview that like my writing was really freed in Guadalajara. And they asked me why you think that was. I'm not quite sure, except that you're all around artists and beautiful culture all the time in Guadalajara. And it just sort of made me say, what am I waiting for? And stop being afraid of your writing and pursuing art and just go for it.
Which brings me to then what brought you back on the flip side of that. What brought you back to Kansas?
Yeah, I really...
That sounds pretty amazing.
Yeah, and I didn't really want to come back. And the only thing that brought me back to Kansas was more opportunities here. You know, I was doing all this great work in Guadalajara on the writing side. I had lots of friends and had set up sort of my little community and was happy there. And my friends from the United States would start visiting me in Guadalajara, and they'd always have these cool little gadgets, you know, iPhones and things like that. And I started missing that, not having these cool little gadgets. And
really?
Weird. I know. It's crazy. But I just never had money in Guadalajara. I mean, I never had money to buy those things. I was working two jobs in Guadalajara and writing. And I just wanted, you know, you work so hard in Mexico for so little. I know what that feels like. And even though I had family in the States that would probably be willing to send me money if I needed it, I just miss sort of those luxury things. I miss going to the grocery stores and being able to say, yeah, I want to buy a bag of Oreos and have the money to do it. And cool little phones and iPads and iPhones and things like that that all my friends had. So I, under the pressure of material things, how superficial, I came back to the United States. And one of the things I did was I didn't want to forget my experience in Guadalajara. I know how much, you know, the United States can kind of envelop you and wrap you up and you forget what you learned. So I sent a postcard to myself from Guadalajara saying, you know, Angela, I wrote it in Spanish. I said, Angela, don't forget your dreams to keep writing. Be sure you continue to practice your Spanish and don't forget to be brave and send out your writing. And I got that postcard 2 weeks after I got back to Kansas, and it really just kind of put another match under my feet to, like, get started again and not to forget what I learned in Guadalajara.
When you say not to forget what you learned, what did you learn?
You know, just everything in Mexico is so, well, my experience, and I was only in Guadalajara, but just the love for art, the love for culture is all around you all the time. People are taking risks every day. People are working very hard, and they're not afraid of hard work. And everyone's always trying to make things better. And they love their family, and they love their stories and their history. And that all just sort of just made me want to be like that, too, like to take those, don't take those things for granted, to appreciate life a little more and not to be so afraid that what people are going to say. And if I send my story out and I get a rejection, so what? You know, after living in Mexico and Guadalajara, I just really wasn't afraid what people had to say about anything anymore.
Do you keep in touch with, it sounds like you are part of an, kind of an artistic community and maybe even a writer's community there. Do you keep in touch with the people who were like your collaborators there?
I do. There's two that are still there in Guadalajara that live there, and I stay in touch with them. And whenever I go, I reach out to them. But everyone else has gone on. Like two of my friends are in Germany now. Another one is, I don't know, somewhere in Europe. And so I've lost track with a few of them. But the two in Guadalajara I stay in touch with.
Can you talk to me about the reception of Coco in Mexico a little bit?
Yeah, so, you know, they released the film in Mexico a whole month before they released it here in the United States, Coco. And it did very well. It was the number one movie in Mexico for several weeks, almost a month, I think it was the number one movie. And the cool thing about that, it was also the only movie and the only number one movie to be an animated film. So that really says something. Mexico really values that movie and the message and loves that movie.
So before we go, we're going to listen to a song from Coco, and it's a famous song called La Llorona.
Ooh.
We'll be listening to that on our way out. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
La Llorona?
Yeah.
Okay. This song is amazing. I mean, anyone who knows Mexican music and ballads will know this song. I'm not sure if this is, I don't remember who the author or writer of this song is, but it's a song about the crying woman, the weeping woman, which is a big legend in our Mexican and Mexican-American culture.
Can you tell us that legend?
Yes, La Llorona. Okay, so there are a lot of different versions. But the one I grew up with was that La Llorona was a young woman who got married. Her husband started ignoring her, so she was mad. And so she killed her children in a river to spite him. And then when she woke up, she realized her children were dead. She killed herself. And now she goes around roaming the streets, calling out their names, looking for their children, like, Gina,
oh my God.
Matthew, looking for her children so she can also drag them to the river. But there's so many different versions, okay? I met a friend from Panama who had a different version of it. My friends from the, you know, the Navajo communities in New Mexico have a different story for it. Other Mexicans even have different stories for it. So it's just kind of this legend that changes. But that's the one I learned growing up in Topeka, Kansas.
Okay, not all stories, like, have a moral, but is there a message that you think is to be taken from this
story?
Sure,
it's like, kids, get off the street. When your parents tell you to go home, get to bed so you don't get picked up by La Llorona. I mean, you do not want that La Llorona after you.
Well, Angela Cervantes, thank you so much. We're listening to La Llorona on the way out. And it's been so great talking to you today.
Thank you for having me.
Angela is the author of the junior novelization of Disney's Coco, and we'll have to bring her back when her next book comes out. It's coming out soon. When we return, how about this weather we're having? If cold temperatures and sleet and snow are your call to the great outdoors, tell us about the appeal, the precautions you take at 816-235-2888. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now I suspect you have noticed that it is cold. That it's gotten a lot colder this morning, in fact, and a lot of us are fearfully anticipating hours of the treacherous ice and sleet and freezing rain that we've been hearing we can expect today, doing everything in our power to stay inside. But there are people who feel much differently about it, people who get really excited to go out and do stuff, even and maybe especially when it's cold. One of our guests does a 5K trail run scheduled every year in January. It's called the Psychopathic 5K, and the January installment is known as the ice version, and this marks the 11th year they've done it, so apparently it's popular. Ben Holmes, good morning. Hi, Ben.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. So, we put on a few races in the wintertime, one on first weekend in December, and then in January, and then we have a really big one. We had 485 people at a 50K, and
Was that?
50 kilometers.
And that's in the cold.
Yes, that's in February.
Two marathons almost.
No, it's about 5 miles further than a marathon.
Sorry. So, I'm not good at math.
That one's very popular. It's called the Psycho Wico Run Toto Run. And it's, I think, the 14th year for it. And have people from 25 states and a couple of countries, and it's very popular.
So I want to understand this run that's coming up. You call it the toughest trail run in the Midwest. And I'm curious about whether you are referring in any way to the weather or that's just incidental.
Well, it's a tough 5K in that it has a few hundred feet of elevation change in 5 kilometers. There's three large hills that you hit twice since it's an out and back. And it's a very technical trail.
What do you mean by that, technical trail?
It's rocky and there's roots and there's one section that's about a 30% grade. And on the way out, if you're a fast runner, if you start very fast going down it, you better have some leg speed left so you don't, fall on your face on the way down.
We
had a wreck. Yes.
Oh, we had a wreck. That entices me. Sorry. Go on.
Well, it's a tough race. We have, I think the record on it is 17 minutes, 34 seconds by Paul Heffron, who is a world-class runner. And he said it was a lot of fun. He was anaerobic the whole way. But
what do you mean by that? See, I need to explain something here. Like when we talk about trail running, we're talking about unpaved courses.
Correct. Yes.
And when he said he's anaerobic the whole way, what does that mean?
That means that he basically was not running aerobically. He was practically, his lungs were bleeding the whole way. He was pushing that hard, and he had a great time.
That doesn't sound like a great time to me. Weather totally aside.
Yeah, it's a challenging run, and people can hike it also, so it's not, there's some people that'll take an hour and 15 minutes to hike it, but uh, it's you know, it's just a fun run. We have kids do it.
I want to jump in here. Yep. If this thing had been scheduled, so you've got like inclines and like downhill slopes and rocks and roots and all of that, if this thing had been scheduled for a day where it's like sleeting or sub-zero temperatures, would you consider canceling it? Or would it be like, bring it on, this is it, this is why we do this in January?
No, that's part of the fun. You know, there's just, basically there's no, you know, to paraphrase a Norwegian saying, there's no bad weather, just inappropriate clothing and or footwear.
So,
and
yeah,
go ahead.
The idea of going out for a run in the absolute coldest Midwestern weather and doing it on, you know, unpaved roads, meaning there is the possibility of being sort of like isolated. And if I was going to do something that I thought might be dangerous, which this kind of does sound to me, but then I am kind of a wuss. But like, I would want to do it where the light of day might shine on me and people might discover that I'd like twisted my ankle or something.
Well, there might not be anyone coming along there for a while. So we have group runs year round. And in fact, in that part, Wyandotte County Lake Park, every Thursday we have a run. And currently Dan Jarrell heads that up. And many years, Maddie and Ashley Mullins headed that up. But people run 4 to 7 miles. And that's every weekend of the year.
So what precautions do you just personally as a runner take when you go out in crazy cold weather or like inclement weather?
Basically, you dress for 20 degrees warmer than what it is outside.
20 degrees warmer?
Because you will heat up. So if it's 0 degrees Fahrenheit out, you dress for 20 degrees. And because you will warm up as you run, myself, my hands get cold. So I will wear gloves and then maybe mittens over the gloves. My feet never seem to get cold, so I don't worry about that. And then my ears also get cold, so I wear a buff or, you know, some kind of headgear where my ears are covered. And then dress appropriately. Lots of times I'll wear a vest some mixture of merino wool or polypropylene kind of clothing. You just dress appropriately and you're fine.
When you say that the cold weather is part of the fun, what do you mean by that? Can you help me understand it as someone who has never done what you are describing? And because it doesn't sound that fun.
Well, it's challenging to the body, and I think environmental conditioning should be part of people's physical endeavors. And that includes being in the heat and humidity. It takes about 10 runs in the heat and humidity for your body to adjust. Your body adapts very well to cold or heat. It just takes a little while. And then there's those transitional periods when we go from like early December when we had like 70 some odd degree weather, and then all of a sudden it's really cold and you're going, I have to adjust here. But anyone who walks their dog every day and their dog insists on going for a walk no matter what, they understand what I'm saying. It's you know, you don't have to be a trail runner or anything else. It's environmental conditioning, you know, and it's good for your body. It's good for your mind. It's good for your soul, I think, to push your limits and just see what you can do and see how your body adapts. It's just great. And
okay.
Trail running this time of year on our Thursday night runs, you have to run with a headlamp or flashlight because it's dark out at 6 p.m. when we start to run. And that's, you know, another factor in there. And it's just amazing how many people show up for a run.
That's really cool.
I run a lot.
Hey, I'm going to bring in some callers here, but we'll be getting back to you. Okay. So hang on.
Sounds good.
I want to talk to Anita in Kansas City. Hi, Anita. Thanks for calling 816-235-2888.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. I just wanted to share an excursion that my sister and I took just a week or so ago at the Lus Bluffs National Wildlife Refuge, which is north of St. Joe, close to the Missouri River. And the bluffs were created by wind and glacier and, you know, thousands of years ago, whatever. But it also has a natural wetlands. And we missed the migratory pattern of the ducks and geese and, you know, flying through. But we took a nice hike in a couple of different areas there, and we saw a lot of eagles, some mature bald eagles and some immature.
So, like, there are things to see out there this time of year is what you're suggesting.
Well, you know, not as much as I thought. I thought we would, you know, see the ducks or geese, but the water was frozen. The wetland was, there's a couple of lakes, and they were frozen over. So there were no ducks or geese because when they see the ice, I guess they just keep going, according to somebody. But we did see a coyote out there on the ice looking for something to eat.
Anita, what is it that inspires you to go hiking in the kind of weather we've had this winter?
It is, first of all, well, it's quiet and it is pretty. And there was, we saw one other car. We talked to one other gentleman. We were there essentially by ourselves, and the terrain is different. You know, the kinds of things you see are a little different. The trees are barren. You know, the grass is kind of a golden color, and it's got its own natural beauty that both of us love, my sister and I both love. And we're outdoors in the cold.
Yeah.
Love that. Both of us love being outdoors. It's exhilarating.
Thank you, Anita. Well, speaking of the beauty of cold weather, it may be obvious that hardcore athletes like trail runners would be unintimidated by plunging weather, but we also have an artist with us. We'll be hearing from him about why he goes outdoors when we return. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about going outside in really cold weather, ice, snow, sleet, that kind of thing, for fun. We've been talking to a trail runner about that, Ben Holmes, and we have some callers, and I'm excited to get to them. If you want to tell us about what you do out there in the cold, why you do it, maybe a good story, you can call 816-235-2888. But first, we have another guest with us this morning, an artist. Corey Antis is a professor at the Kansas City Art Institute, and he was involved in the Kansas City Plein Air Coterie. That's KCPAC for short. It's a group that organized outdoor art-making sessions. Hi, Corey.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
So, what are your general feelings about cold weather, pro or anti?
I love cold weather. I'm not a native Midwesterner. I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. But I went to school in upstate New York, where winter begins in September. It snowed on my birthday one year in May, so I've come to really like the cold weather. But I also didn't start really painting outside in it until I came to Kansas City and I started working with some of the other artists with KCPAC. And since KCPAC has been on kind of hiatus for the last few years, I've just continued to, along with some of my friends and sometimes on my own, to go out, paint in the weather, and it really has been all kinds of different weather.
Tell me about that experience, just what it's like.
I was listening to what Ben was saying about the potential for injury with trail running, and I don't think that the potential is the same with painting outside, though I have gotten frostbite.
You just casually say, though I have gotten frostbite.
It's not that severe, but more because I just wasn't prepared for how long I was going to be painting outside. But I think that the difference between the relationship between trail running and what Ben was describing and what for me for going outside to paint is that you're trying to think about how the experience of a scenario, not just the facts or the science of what it is that you're seeing, can be translated into the work that you make. And a lot of the conversations with the other artists that were in Casey Pack and painters that I know who go out and work now are about these divisions between the things that artists do in the studio, in these rooms that they spend thousands of hours working in alone, and the things and the information they get when they're outside, and the kinds of present tense awareness that you can, as Ben put it, kind of environmentally condition yourself to be more aware of or to be more receptive to.
Can you tell me about something you've painted outside in the cold and how the experience of the cold translates into the painting that you see, not just in terms of what you saw, but in terms of what your whole body was experiencing?
I mean, I can tell you that the painting froze. I had to learn a lot about the fact that watercolor is a water-based media and that when it's 10 below zero, water's going to freeze. It does feel sometimes that you're painting on a soggy saltine cracker that happens to be like 22 by 30 inches. And I remember bringing the painting back inside into the car and trying desperately to not let it unfreeze, so that it didn't end up looking like a really unfocused version of whatever it is I was trying to depict. I think we all know most materials just don't like the cold or extreme cold, but one of your callers mentioned the quiet, and I think that that's something that everyone, whether you're an artist or not, can appreciate, that there's a relationship to the quietude and also just to the specificity of what cold weather can offer you, and just that when a lot of people are in the environment, you can't.
Do you find the Midwestern winter landscape inspiring visually? Because I would say, like, we've already heard this word come up in an enthusiastic tone, but it's not the word barren. That's the word people use to describe that landscape.
I wouldn't put it like that. I just recently did a residency in Matfield Green in the Flint Hills this past summer, and I'd been out to the Flint Hills in the wintertime, and it was like, I think like a lot of people describe it, it's not like anything that you've ever seen before. It's oceanic, but it's, of course, just prairie grass. Not just prairie grass, but...
But not water.
No, it's certainly not water. But the connectedness, I think, between how you behave in space and how you depict it, I think that there's a natural relationship between how, and vice versa, between those two states. And I think about an artist like Wilbur Niewald, who's probably the most well-known landscape painter in this region, and of course he's known beyond this region. I don't know if Wilbur still paints outside in the wintertime. I know he, of course, paints outside during the summers, but those have become iconic images. And I think that they have also conditioned the way that we think about what the Midwestern landscape can be as an identity.
Well, I'm going to get back to talking with you about being cold, but let's go ahead and bring in our callers to talk with you and with Ben, our trail runner. I want to hear first from Rod. Rod is with us from KCK. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Yeah, I do a lot of bicycle commuting, and my record for riding to work was 2 degrees. But New Year's Day, I woke up and it was 6 below, and me and my wife got super excited, and we layered up with, 2 layers of long underwear into the pants and balaclava and face mask and the whole, Carhartt mittens and all that stuff. And we went out and got a picture of ourselves by the bank sign with the -5 degrees. It had warmed up a whole degree.
So when you got excited, are you able to express what was exciting about this to you, that you were going to get to go on a bike ride in -6 degrees?
I think so, because it was a personal record. 5 years ago, I'd done the 2 degrees. And, I feel like anyone can go ride a bike when it's 79 degrees. And if you want to ride year round and you're not going to ride in the cold, you're going to have to move San Diego or something. And it's not that I'm that tough. I'm not. It's a matter of dressing for it. Like I said, I had multiple layers, long cotton t-shirt under a cycling jacket, under a heavy wool sweater, a Hawaiian shirt over the top, just style. I don't think that contributed to warmth at all, but
I like it though.
The Carhartt mittens, honestly, I sweated them up. I don't know how cold it would have to be before those Carhartt mittens aren't enough.
Well, so this brings up the question of, and I want to pose this question to our in-studio guest. Thank you, Rod. What do you guys ever think, just your experiences doing this, that we've gotten too comfortable, that we've gotten, that our window for comfort has gotten maybe just kind of more narrow than it needs to be? I'll start with you, Corey.
It's a great question. I think that it's something that I talk a lot about with my students, because so much of the way that they receive, they look at other art is through reproduction, is through, you know, and I think that I'm not the first person to say that we are surrounded by copies of things. And I mean, a lot of us spend a lot of time on our phones in front of screens. It's a wake up call when you realize that the cold does not care about you. The landscape has no ego. It doesn't. I mean, I've definitely found when I'm an hour or two into a painting and I realize that I'm miserable. But I'm halfway through the actual project, that I could shake my fist at the sky or something, but it's not going to make any difference in terms of what's there. So,
and that's an important experience to have as a human.
I think it is. I think it's important. But I can hear your skepticism.
No, it's not that. I just want to understand.
No, I mean, I'm skeptical about it too. I don't think it's just a romantic or kind of like masochistic experience that you feel like, or that one has to kind of go through in order to make work. But there is something that's important about the actual work that at least I feel I make, and I know other artists feel, that it doesn't necessarily lend it more legitimacy, but there's something that allows me to be surprised by having information outside of my own comfortable experience, when that discomfort forces me to become more aware of the things that I haven't anticipated in a warm and comfortable studio.
Like that you need to be careful not to get frostbite.
Right. I need to have more than one pair of fingerless gloves.
Ben, what about you? I mean, what do you think about this idea of our window for comfort right now as a culture?
I think as a culture, we're used to being indoors looking at screens under artificial lighting, and we are too complacent and comfortable. And getting out of your comfort zone and actually getting out into nature, like Anita, a previous caller, talked about seeing wildlife. You see so much wildlife. You see snow geese on our trail runs and bald eagles and bobcat and deer, and it's wonderful to get out into nature and become more self-aware, as Corey said, and actually experience something other than, you know, the artificial. And you become a more grounded, self-aware person if you get outdoors. And that can be just taking your dog for a walk around, you know, the neighborhood when it's very cold, or, you know, inclement weather, and you know, just getting outdoors.
Yeah.
and doing something.
Let's hear from Clinton, who takes children to do that. Clinton's given us a call. Hi, Clinton.
Hi.
What can you share?
Well, I'm a scoutmaster of a Boy Scout troop, and we go camping once a month with the Boy Scouts, regardless of weather. And our Boy Scouts range anywhere from 10 and a half years old to 18 years old. And we're going camping this weekend. So we will be out in tents in the weather this weekend. You can all think about us while we're out there. The boys love it. You know, they we'll be out. I think they're calling for a high of 20 and a low of 10. The boys will be cheering, hoping that 10 drops down to zero, because they get special awards if they camp in sub-zero temperatures. You know, for them, it's a sort of a rite of passage. They get a little bit of bragging rights based on the different things that they experience while they're out camping.
I'm guessing some of the scouts love this more than others.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, and from just a scouting perspective, some of the things that we do as Boy Scouts, even in nice weather, like we don't allow electronic devices, on our scout campouts and that kind of stuff. So there are some of them, you know, that are so addicted to their smartphone and that kind of stuff that just that is a challenge for them.
That's too uncomfortable.
But, Right, exactly. But yeah, I mean, if you think about it, there are thousands of Boy Scouts in the just in the Kansas City metropolitan area that camp every month. And so on any given weekend, if you look out and the weather's nasty, you can almost guarantee that there are at least a few hundred Boy Scouts out in it in tents.
Overnight. Well, Clinton, you may hear this music, but we have to go. But thank you. That's I am shamed by the knowledge that while I cannot step outside for a walk, there are children out there camping. Corey Antis with us from the Art Institute. Thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
And thanks also to Ben Holmes. He's with us from the Psychedelic 5K Trail Run Ice Version coming up. Thanks, Ben.
Thank you.
You can listen back to our conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard. And our morning newscaster, Kyle Palmer, has been asking people to tweet him images of the winter weather today. So if you were inspired to go out and take pictures, you can send them to @KCURKyle and include us too. We're @KCURCST. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. I'm Gina Kaufman, back tomorrow with a soup and stew food show. Up to date is next.